all sides. Since the beginning of the organization's efforts to integrate Central High, Arkansas Attorney General Bennett had harassed its officials. First, he demanded they submit the names and addresses of all members and contributors. When the groups failed to do so, he arrested the organization's leaders. He had also filed suit claiming that both the NAACP and the Legal Defense and Education Fund were New York corporations doing business in Arkansas illegally. Although it had seemed at first that the NAACP was winning the struggle, not being able to halt the suits was a setback. One piece of good news was that the Thomas Plan for our immediate withdrawal and gradual, in the distant future, integration was being rejected by all sides. Thomas had met with those people from our community who condescended to meet with him. They had rejected his plan, calling it a step backward, and the Mothers League and the Citizens Council rejected it because they didn't want to support the idea of integration even in the far distant future. Nevertheless, there were signs all around us, at school and in the newspapers, that segregationists were making headway. The later it got in the month of May, the more the pace of harassment quickened. After Terry got hit on the head by a rowdy group of boys who cornered him, Mrs. Huckabee suggested we come to school only when we had to take final exams or attend classes critical to our completing the year. We would enter school, go directly to those classes, and leave immediately after them. She instructed us to let her know when we entered the building and where we were at all times. We were told that the school board was hiring private guards to beef up hall security in response to threats of major violence. Word also came that the FBI would be present at graduation because of the threats of bombs and Ku Klux Klan activity planned to disrupt the ceremony. Little Rock police and armed federalized Arkansas guardsmen would also be on hand to keep the peace. "Stay home. Promise me you won't go to graduation," Link pleaded on the telephone. "I'm not gonna let them scare me away," I protested. "Listen, I've been in rooms where people are talking about harsh ways to stop that boy's graduation. They're saying if they let the first one of you graduate, there'll be no end to integration. Melba, listen up good. They're bragging about using high-powered rifles. They're taking bets about which way you all are gonna fall when they shoot you." 28. Central High School Negroes pass. One on honor roll. Principal Matthew says he will not reveal grades, but confirms Green will graduate. Arkansas Gazette, Wednesday, May 23, 1958. "Let's keep the nigger from graduating." That was the rallying cry in the halls of Central High that unleashed unimaginable terror upon us. Pressure was exerted on all eight of us. The goal was to get us out by any means possible. In case that plan failed, our antagonist worked at convincing us that even if Ernie had the grades to graduate, he should not march with the other seniors to receive his Central High diploma.
"We ain't gonna let no nigger wear our cap and gown,"
one boy shouted at me as I walked the hallway to English class. I pushed my way past him, flashed a smile, and a pleasant thank you. At first, some of my late-night telephone callers pleaded with me in a civil tone to ask Ernie to receive his diploma by mail. "We don't want his picture taken with us. My daddy says you all ain't getting back in our school next year, no how. So this is the only time we'll have that ink spot in the middle of all those pictures the news people take." Another gruff-voiced man became angrier with each rude call. We're gonna hang us a nigger at the same time your nigger takes our diploma, he said. On and on those calls came, keeping our phone ringing almost as much as it had at the beginning of the school year. At the same time, I received threatening notes sneaked into my books and in my locker. I could see more evidence that the principal, vice principals, and teachers had lost any hopes of corralling belligerent students. Even as school officials observed them, clusters of students threw rocks as we entered or exited the building. The hallways were like a three-ring circus, with hooligans completely ignoring commands to cease their outrageous behavior. Because the situation was growing more explosive, Mrs. Huckabee called us into her office to double-check on our scheduled exams. While inside school, we were once again closely followed by bodyguards. I was much more frightened than I had been in recent months because there were no longer islands of sanity within the insanity of that school. Just outside the principal's office, people threw rotten eggs and walked on my heels, whereas before, that area had been a comparatively safe place to walk. During those last days, time seemed to drag on and on, as though some divine force were slowing the hands on the clock. I had no choice but to perform one of the most hazardous duties of the day, opening my locker. That meant standing still for several minutes, with my eyes and attention focused inside, while my back was exposed to passerby. I had developed a habit of reaching my hand into my locker to find hidden objects before I poked my face in. On Tuesday afternoon, I was searching my locker for my eyeglass case when I reached my hand down deep inside to see whether or not it had fallen. Suddenly, there was the sound of popping guns and the smell of smoke just behind me. I quickly turned to see a flaming object flying toward my face. I put my hand up to deflect it. That's when I felt the pain on my first three fingers. I had shielded my eyes from several sparking hot firecrackers linked together by a wire. My hand hurt, but I could only be grateful it wasn't my eyes that had been burned. As I was issued bandages from the office to dress the wound, I consoled myself by thinking of the calendar on the kitchen wall. I had marked off almost all the days of the month of May. Ernie would attend baccalaureate services the following Sunday evening, and graduation would be the following Tuesday, 1 week from this day. I would be an unwelcome Central High student in that building only a few more days.
What are you staring at, nigger?
I was indeed staring, transfixed and elated at seeing what the boy was carrying. It was the sight I had been waiting for, praying for.
The graduation gown Ernie's gonna wear,
I said loud and clear. I couldn't help responding to his snide remark as I glared back at the boy wearing a flat top haircut and black shirt. In his right hand, he was carrying his gown on a hanger, and his left hand was holding his cap. He was attempting to block my way, but he had no free hands. I simply made a wide circle around him. Nothing, not even his foul mouth spewing ugly words, could make me unhappy at that moment. The sight of that gown meant summer and freedom were right around the corner. At home, the phone calls were coming fast and furious.
We got a way of getting you darkies now, for certain. We're offering $10,000 for your head on a platter.
I gulped as I replaced the receiver in its cradle. I couldn't help thinking about how that was an awful lot of money. Poor folks might take a notion to collect. They'd get $10,000 for my head. Did that mean they'd have to cut it off to collect? I told Grandma India of my fears.
Surely you've got something better to do besides speculating about white folks' silliness, she said.
I can't help worrying about Ernie. One of those students could be an imposter. Anybody could wear a robe.
Imposter?
Grandma looked up from her needlework with a question. You know, someone from the KKK who wants to collect that reward money could pretend to be a graduate. I don't think Ernie is in any real danger during graduation, because he'll be there among 601 white graduates. Besides, God's watching after Ernie, just like he's watching over you. But I tried to continue being in my pity pot. She motioned me to shush my mouth and hold my hands out so she could circle the embroidery thread around them to straighten it out. After a long moment, she said, You're fretting a mighty lot this evening. Hard work is always the cure for worry. So, busy yourself doing those dishes and getting ready for your final exams. I had always imagined that my last day of the term at Central High School would be marked by a grand ceremony, with a massive choir singing Hallelujah, or perhaps some wonderful award from my community. A parade, maybe. I imagined the roar of helicopters overhead, towing flying banners of congratulations, something, anything. But it was just the same as any other day. Four of us, Thelma, Elizabeth, Jeff, and I, rode home together early that afternoon. We wouldn't be going back to Central High for at least 3 months. Long spaces of silence punctuated our talk about how we thought we did on our exams.
It's over,
Conrad said, greeting me as I climbed the steps to our front door.
You don't have to integrate anymore.
Well, praise the Lord, Grandma India said, her arms wide open to receive me. You see, you made it. She squeezed me and kissed my cheek. Well, well, young lady, welcome to summer. Mother Lois handed me a large box that I rushed to open. You're very special to have come through all this. I thought you deserved a special summer outfit. Early on Wednesday morning, I built a fire in the metal trash barrel in the backyard, fueled by my school papers. Grandma had said it would be healing to write and destroy all the names of people I disliked at Central High, teachers, students, anyone who I thought had wronged me. It was against the law to burn anything at that time of the year, but she said a ceremony was important in order to have the official opportunity to give that year to God. Grandma India stood silent by my side as I fed the flame and spoke their names and forgave them. After a long moment, she walked over to water her flower bed. The 4 o'clocks were blooming purple and red. We stood together for what must have been half an hour, with only the sound of the crackling fire and the garden hose. Finally, she said, Later, you'll be grateful for the courage it built inside you and for the blessing it will bring. Grateful, I thought. Never. How could I be grateful for being at Central High? But I knew she was always right. Still, I wondered just how long I would have to wait for that feeling of gratitude to come to me. Coverage curbed to assure dignity of Central High graduation. Each graduating senior to receive 8 admission tickets, press admitted only by ticket. Arkansas Gazette, Tuesday, May 27th, 1958. Even though I had made it through the school year, Ernie still had to survive that one final brave act. I counted on being with him, on applauding for him from our isolated though well-guarded section of the audience. None of you will be allowed to attend either the graduation commencement or the baccalaureate service, Mother Lois announced over dinner. The authorities believe it would not only risk your lives, but also make it more difficult for them to protect Ernie and his family should they have to do so. They've also forbidden any non-white reporters or photographers to attend.
But, Mom!
But nothing. This is no time to satisfy a whim and unravel everything you've accomplished. There'll be enough of a circus, what with the soldiers, FBI, city police, and who knows all. The paper says every policeman not on vacation will be on duty from 6 o'clock on. Grandma said, they wouldn't go to all that trouble and expense unless they expected something to happen. Besides, Mother Lois continued, their best efforts should be directed to protecting Ernie. She's right, I thought to myself. It was selfish of me to want to go, I suppose. But what I knew to be practical advice didn't lessen my disappointment at not being able to watch Ernie march triumphantly to the stage to receive that diploma. That night I wrote in my diary, Dear God, please walk with Ernie in the graduation line at Central. Let him be safe. Quigley Stadium was where the 101st Troops set up their headquarters. It was there, on Tuesday evening, May 27th, with 4,500 people looking on, that Ernie received his diploma. I held my breath as I listened to the radio broadcast news of the graduation ceremonies. At 8:48 p.m., Ernie became the first of our people to graduate from Central High School in all its 49 years. Chills danced up my spine as I sat in the big green living room chair with Mama and Grandma nearby. It really happened, I whispered. We made it. The audience had been applauding those who previously marched, but when Ernie appeared, they fell silent.
What the heck?
Mother Lois said. Lots of people in the rest of the world are applauding for Ernie and for all of you who made it through this year. Who cares if they applaud? They didn't shoot him. There was no violence. Everybody is alive and well. Grandma stood and applauded. Ernie was escorted from the stadium by police to a waiting taxi in which he, his family, and their guest departed. The newspaper said Ernie's diploma cost taxpayers $500,000. Of course, we knew it cost all of us much, much more than that. It cost us our innocence and a precious year of our teenage lives. The next morning, Link called, sounding as though he would fall apart. He was grieving because Mrs. Healy had died on the day of his graduation. He insisted I come to meet him. When I said I couldn't get away, he called me 1,000 times that day, insisting he had to see me or something awful would happen. Late that afternoon, I had no choice but to meet him. He threatened to come right over to my house if I didn't agree. I figured I had to quiet him down or he would explode. He seemed inconsolable and really crazy. So, I said we could walk around the block near the Baptist College. It was a safe place for me in my own neighborhood. Besides, when I asked Mother if I could go to the Baptist College library with a friend, I wouldn't be telling a lie. At least, not altogether. When I arrived, he was red-faced and teary-eyed, insisting that I go with him to the northern town near Harvard University, where he would attend college. Things will be much better for you there. I'll take care of you until you get a job. He was so distraught that I felt sorry for him. He insisted that I leave Little Rock immediately. You're just saying this because you're sad about Nana Healy, I told him. You'll feel differently tomorrow. Next week. I've thought about this a lot. I'm tired of worrying about you. What will you do when I'm gone? I can't leave. I have to stay here and go back to Central, I argued. Everything depends on it. You keep acting this way, girl. You are gonna get yourself killed. I told you, there's a price on your head. They have posters all over offering that money. They'll never let you come back next year. On and on he went, talking loud and frightening me. To calm him down, I told him I'd think about running away to the north. But when I waved goodbye to him, I knew I would never, ever see him again. Although I would remember him forever. By May 29th, the eight of us had flown off to Chicago to receive the Robert S. Abbott Award conferred by the Chicago Defender newspaper. I was so excited because Minnie Jean joined us there. It was the beginning of a whirlwind tour and another in the series of awards we received for bravery and significant contributions to democracy. In Little Rock, we had been niggers. But up north, we were heroes and heroines. We were paraded across stages before adoring audiences, chauffeured about in limousines, and treated like royalty at luxurious hotels. In New York, we had suites at the Statler Hilton, took limos to Saudis, and lunched with United Nations Secretary General Doug Hammarskjöld. We hobnobbed backstage with Lena Horne and Ricardo Montalbán at their Broadway play, Jamaica. In Washington, we had a private tour of the White House and posed on the steps of the Supreme Court with Mr. Thurgood Marshall. In Cleveland, we received the NAACP's highest honor, the Spingarn Medal. We received so many other awards in so many cities that I lost count after a while. The first time I was asked for my autograph, I was astonished. Afterward, I went to my room to practice a special signature. But by late June, even as Minnie Jean and I were whirling about our hotel room, dressing to see a man we thought of as a deity, Johnny Mathis, Little Rock school integration was unraveling. On June 22nd, Federal Judge Lemley granted the school board's request for a stay in the integration order for Central High School, delaying it for 3.5 years. The NAACP began a round of appeals up through the courts, trying to get us 7 students back into Central High. By September 1958, we had won our court battle. Armed with judgments in our favor, we prepared to re-enter Central High. But Governor Faubus had the last word. He closed all of Little Rock's high schools. So, we began the school year waiting for the law of the land to blast Mr. Faubus out of his stubborn trench. I couldn't know then that I would spend the entire school year of 1958-59 in lonely isolation and despair, waiting in vain. We had come back home to Little Rock, back to being called niggers by the segregationists and those meddling children by our own people. Our friends and neighbors resented not only the school closure, but most especially the negative economic impact our presence in that school had on our community. By that time, segregationists were squeezing the life out of the NAACP and the Bates' newspaper, the State Press. Our people continued to lose their jobs, their businesses, and their homes as pressure was exerted to convince them to talk us into voluntary withdrawing from Central High. During those lonely days of what would have been my senior year, I waited for legislators and Faubus and the NAACP to resolve the entanglement that surrounded Central High's integration. As September days turned to late autumn, my world fell apart with the onset of Grandmother India's leukemia and her death on October 24th. Ultimately, I was alone, at home, waiting to restart my life, waiting to live my teenage years. By September 1959, We had waited as long as we could for Farbus to open the schools. The unrest in Little Rock and the bounty on our heads had by that time forced two of our seven families to move their homes away from that city forever. NAACP officials sent an announcement to chapters across the country, asking for families that would volunteer to give us safe harbor and support us in finishing our education. I was fortunate enough to come to the Santa Rosa, California home of Dr. George McCabe, a San Francisco State University professor, and his wife, Carol, and their four children. They were a family of politically conscious Quakers committed to racial equality. When I arrived, I was frightened to see that they were white, but they became the loving, nurturing bridge over which I walked to adulthood. More than their guidance, it was their unconditional love that taught me the true meaning of equality. To this day, I call them mom and pop and visit to bask in their love and enjoy the privilege of being treated as though I am their daughter. The love of George and Carol McCabe helped to heal my wounds and inspired me to launch a new life for myself. It was also their voices echoing the same words of my mother that made me enter and complete college. In fact, George took me to college in January 1960 to register for my first classes. Not until September 1960 did the NAACP, with its tenacious legal work, force Central High to open to integration once more, but only two black students were permitted entry. Carlotta Walls and Jefferson Thomas ultimately became graduates of Central, along with Ernest Green. Looking back, I suppose that had Farbus not called out the troops on that first day, had he remained silent, the integration at Central High would not have been as difficult. By dispatching the Arkansas National Guard to keep us out of school, he set the tone. His bold, defiant act gave renegades, who had until then been only a very minor thread in our city's fabric, the green light to play a major role. They took that opportunity and made the most of it, because or in spite of the fact that the world was watching. As I watch videotapes now and think back to that first day at Central High on September 4th, 1957, I wonder what possessed my parents and the adults of the NAACP to allow us to go to that school in the face of such violence. When I ask my mother about it, she says none of them honestly believe Governor Farbus had the unmitigated gall to use the troops to keep us out. Mother explains that they assumed he would order the military to quell the mob. Since Little Rock's citizens had in most recent years behaved fairly rationally, Mother assumed the mob would be dispersed by the police, and that would be the end of that. She recalls as well that even when a rational voice nudged her to keep me home, there seemed to be that tug to go forward from some divine source. Many historians contend it was a brilliant stroke on the governor's part suddenly to remove the Arkansas National Guard from around Central High School in response to Judge Ronald Davies' ruling for integration on Friday, September 20th, 1957. It allowed Farbus to set up an explosive situation while maintaining a veneer of innocence. He could ignite and fuel segregationist anger without being caught holding the matches. When on that ominous day, Mob Monday, September 23rd, 1957, the NAACP officials and ministers dropped us off to go to Central for the second time under court order, I wonder how, in their minds, they justified such an act. As an adult, I believe had it been me driving, I would have kept going rather than allow my children to face that rampaging mob. And yet, had we students not gone to school that day, perhaps the integration of Central and of a whole string of other Southern schools that eventually followed would never have taken place. When I watch news footage of the day we entered school, guarded by the 101st soldiers, I am moved by the enormity of that experience. I believe that was a moment when the whole nation took one giant step forward. Once President Eisenhower made that kind of commitment to uphold the law, there was no turning back. And even though later on he would waver and not wholeheartedly back his powerful decision, he had stepped over a line that no other president had ever dared cross. Thereafter, the threat of military intervention would always exist whenever a Southern governor thought of using his office to defy federal law. I marvel at the fact that in the midst of this historic confrontation, we 9 teenagers weren't maimed or killed. Believe me, it was only by the grace of God and the bravery of those few good men, some of them white men. I never allow myself to forget that, although I was abused by many white people during that incident. Without the help of other law-abiding whites who risked their lives, I wouldn't be around to tell this story. Yet even as I wince at the terrible risk we all took, I remember thinking at the time that it was the right decision, because it felt as though the hand of fate was ushering us forward. Naive and trusting, adults and children alike, we kept thinking each moment, each hour, each day, that things would get better, that these people would come to their senses and behave. This is a land governed by sane citizens who obey the law. At least, that's what we're taught in history class. So, we headed down a path from which there was no turning back, because when we thought of alternatives, the only option was living our lives behind the fences of segregation and passing on that legacy to our children. Today, when I see how far we have progressed in terms of school integration, in some instances I am pleased. In other areas, I am very angry. Why have we not devised a workable plan for solving a problem that has so long plagued this nation? We put a man on the moon because we committed the resources to do so. Today, 36 years after the Central High crisis, school integration is still not a reality, and we use children as tender warriors on the battlefield to achieve racial equality. It would take years of sorting out my Central High experience before the pieces of my life puzzle would come together and I could make sense of what happened to me. In 1962, when I had attended the mostly white San Francisco State University for 2 years, I found myself living among an enclave of students where I was the only person of color. I was doing it again, integrating a previously all-white residence house, even though I had other options. I had been taken there as a guest, and someone said the only blacks allowed there were the cooks. So, of course, I made application and donned my warrior garb because it reminded me of the forbidden fences of segregation in Little Rock. One night, a brown-haired soldier wearing olive drab fatigues stepped across the threshold of my suite. His name was John, and he was a blind date for Mary, my roommate. Of course, for just an instant, he reminded me of my 101st Guard, same stature, same uniform. When he tried to talk to me that evening, I ignored him. But the next morning, Saturday, he rang our doorbell. When I told him that Mary had already left, John said never mind. He'd really come back to see me. He brought me strawberries in dead of winter and flowers every weekend. 6 months later, I had married this bright, kind, green-eyed martial arts expert who said he would protect me forever. Later, I would come to understand that he represented Danny, my 101st guard, Link, my protector, the power of those who held sway over me at Central High, and the safety that my black uncles and father could not provide in the South. If you can't beat them, you're going to join them, my mother said when I nervously announced my wedding from a phone booth in Reno. I hope you've thought this over, young lady. It's not the racial difference. It's the philosophical difference that is most important. 7 years later, John and I split up because he had been a farm boy who wanted a wife to putter about the house and have babies. I wanted to be a news reporter, but he had by then shared with me the most wonderful event in my life, the birth of our daughter, Kelly. As I held the cinnamon-colored bundle with auburn hair and doe-like eyes in my arms, I swore she would never have to endure the racial prejudices I endured. I was wrong. But then, that's a story for another book. Until my marriage, I had been hearing from my old friend Link, living in faraway places as he piled up awards and degrees from this country's most prestigious educational institutions. He was livid about my marriage, saying I'd all along told him we couldn't date because he was white. And now look what I've gone and done. I never heard from him again. Still, I think of him as a hero. Yet another one of those special gifts from God sent to ferry me over a rough spot in my life's path. Indeed, I followed my dream, inspired by those journalists I met during the integration. I attended Columbia University's School of Journalism and became a news reporter. I always remembered it was the truth told by those reporters who came to Little Rock that kept me alive. Later, as an NBC television reporter, covering stories of riot and protest, I would take special care to look into those unexposed corners where otherwise invisible people are forced to hide as their truth is ignored. I look back on my Little Rock integration experience as ultimately a positive force that shaped the course of my life. As Grandma India promised, it taught me to have courage and patience. Some observers have said that its negative impact may have been that it forced me to live my life as a marginal woman in two worlds, white and black, by virtue of my early experience with the Maccabees and my marriage. But I see that as a distinct advantage, for it has allowed me to know for certain that we are all one. If my Central High School experience taught me one lesson, it is that we are not separate. The effort to separate ourselves, whether by race, creed, color, religion, or status, is as costly to the separator as to those who would be separated. When the milk in Oregon is tainted by the radiation eruption of a Soviet nuclear reactor, we are forced to see our interdependence. When forgotten people feel compelled to riot in Los Angeles, we share their pain through our TV screens, and their ravages impact our emotional and economic health. The task that remains is to cope with our interdependence, to see ourselves reflected in every other human being, and to respect and honor our differences. Namaste. The God in me sees and honors the God in you. This concludes Warriors Don't Cry. Please visit our website, www.tantor.com, for more information on our growing library of unabridged audiobooks and to take advantage of special offers, or call toll-free 877-7-T-A-N-T-O-R to request a catalog.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.